the opportunity to thank the organizers for inviting me and for all the people who made this conference possible. I'm really enjoying being here. Okay, let's start right away. I want to tell you something today about a way of seeing the quantum to classical transition. And let me start by the motivation, classical versus quantum. So we know that classical physics has some very nice features. It takes place in a well-defined, very nice phase space. Everything is continuous. The time evolution of systems is governed by the Newton's equations. Everything fulfills local realism, so there's no way to violate the Bell inequality in classical physics. It fulfills macroscopic realism. This is a very important concept which I will define on a few slides, so it's not necessary that you know it already now. And everything is deterministic, so there's this grid of rods and clocks. And in classical mechanics, everything is a bit more abstract. We have Hilbert space in which the states are living. We have quantization of events, so finally there is only clicks. Time evolution is given by the Schrödinger equation and the projection postulate. And in quantum mechanics, we can violate local realism. So we can prepare entangled states that are such correlated, which it can never happen in the classical world. And quantum physics allows us to violate macroscopic realism. And intrinsic randomness is built into it. So you're seeing already now that I'm referring to quantum mechanics in the low energy non-relativistic case here and classical physics as Newtonian physics. OK. And now I want to pose the following question and hope that I will answer them in the rest of the talk. Does this mean that the classical world is substantially different from the quantum world? And more concretely, since the world around us is classical, but at least I fully believe in quantum physics, that it should be universally valid, when and how do physical systems to behave to stop quantumly and start behaving classically? And what I want to give you today is such a picture of a quantum to classical transition without referring to an environment. So a few not at variance with decoherence, but complementary to it. And what I also want to point out, I want to give you a view within quantum physics. So we're not referring to any collapse models like Irani-Fermini-Weber or Penrose, which put additional laws to quantum mechanics to forbid macroscopic superpositions. So no decoherence and no collapse models. So I invite you to maybe forget for the next 30 minutes your personal views and try to share it like that. And especially, do not think about interpretations of quantum mechanics. I will use the standard mathematical apparatus of Schrödinger equation and projection postulate. Not more than that. No more than that. So then you can ask yourself more concretely, what are the key ingredients for having a non-classical time evolution? And a priori, there are some candidates, and I wrote some of them down. It could be the initial state of the quantum system. It could be the Hamiltonian governing the time evolution of the system. It could be the measurement observables. And maybe you have something more in your mind. And at the end of the talk, I will give you the answer. This is to make you curious. OK, let me now define the concept of macroscopic realism, or macrorealism, which is important for having a tool of distinguishing between quantum and classical time evolution. It's a concept introduced by Leggett and Garg already in the 80s, and it's a conjunction of two postulates. So like local realism introduced by Bell, this is now another concept, which is only for one system evolving in time, not for two systems in space. So I said it's two postulates. This is the first one. It's macrorealism per se, which says that a macroscopic object that in principle can be in macroscopically distinct states is at any given time in one of them. This is the postulate. And the second one is non-invasive measurability, which is the postulate telling you that in principle it's possible to find out the state the system is in without disturbing the system and also without disturbing its subsequent time evolution. So this is the example I want to give you. Consider you have some macroscopic object, like an elephant, and you have some property of the elephant, which I call Q, for instance, the parity of the number of feet it has on the ground, then we would all agree that this is such a property. It, at every time, this Q exists, and I can infer it without changing it. But now comes the nice part. If you take this concept of macroscopic realism, so if you take the existing properties which can be measured in a non-invasive way, Then you can derive an inequality, which is true for all these class of theories. So you consider we have a dichotomic quantity Q, so it's plus minus one at all times. And now you consider you have four times, T1, T2, T3, T4. And you prepare always some initial state at time zero. And now if you start measuring temporal correlation functions, so that means you prepare the system and measure it at time T1 and then measure at time T2. Prepare again, measure at 1 and 2. And you do this very often to establish a temporal correlation function between time 1 and time 2. This is C12. And if you do this not only at time 1 and 2, but only in a other sequence of run at times 2 and 3, and at times 3 and 4, and in another run at only times, you measure only times 1 and 4, then this algebraic inequality holds. So this is just a mathematical truth for all classes that fulfill macroscopic realism in analogy to the CHSH inequality. So what does this mean? If you now make an experiment and you have a system evolving in time and you have such a property that you can measure and you violate this inequality, then this means that at least one of the two postulates fails. So either macrorealism per se or non-invasive measurability or both of them. So we all know that this Leggett-Clark inequality can be easily violated in the microscopic world. So if you have a qubit and you let it rotate in some magnetic field, that can be easily violated. And Leggett and Clark didn't invent it for this reason, because obviously it's clear that macroscopic realism is violated in the micro world. They invented it as a tool for showing quantumness in the macroscopic domain, or for checking whether quantum physics allows to violate this Leggett-Clark inequality also in the macroscopic domain. And this is also the spirit I want to use it. So let me first, I can do this very briefly. As I already said, the Leggett-Clark inequality is easily violated for a microscopic quantum system. So consider you have a spin 1/2, and it just rotates around the x coordinate given by sigma x Hamiltonian. And consider your observable is just the sigma z operator. So you just check, is it plus sigma z or minus sigma z? Then the temporal correlation function has this famous cosinus law that you also have in the Bell tests. And you can violate the Leggett-Clark inequality, which is abbreviated by k here, and should be bounded by 2 in macrorealism. You can violate it up to 2 times square root of 2. On the other hand, if you have classical spin vectors, so really numbers with 3 entries in space, and you would have classical spin vectors rotating, there is no way that you can violate the Leggett-Clark inequality. They would have a classical evolution. Okay, the first statement I want to make is that the Leggett-Clark inequality can be violated for practically arbitrary Hamiltonians. So consider, and how does that go? Well, you give me any Hamiltonian, and what I will do is the following. I will prepare some initial state. I will tell you later which. And then I use some other form of the Leggett-Clark inequality, which just assumes that there are 3 possible measurement times, but that's just a technical issue. And then I will just make the measurement asking the system, are you still in the state psi 0, or are you exactly in the complementary Hilbert space to psi 0? So I just measure, are you still in the initial state or not? And the only thing then I have to establish is really Schrödinger time evolution and the survival probability. You plug that in into the Leggett-Clark inequality. This is what appears. It's really not important to follow this now. It's just enough that you see that what I would do is, you give me the Hamiltonian, I would just choose a superposition of 2 energy eigenstates. And then I will always find some delta t, so some possible time distance between my measurements, such that the Leggett-Clark inequality is violated. I'm assuming quantum mechanics here and that the measurements perturb the system. Invasiveness is here the main ingredient for violating. It's really a projective measurement. If you prepare the system at psi 0, at time 0, and at time 1, you ask, are you psi 0? And it says yes, then it's really projected again to psi 0. This is important ingredient here. So what we learn here is that under sharp measurements, where we can really project onto very low dimensional subspaces of the Hilbert space, we can always violate the Leggett-Clark inequality. But this is also not what we consider macroscopically distinct states. So psi 0 and its complementary space are not really macroscopically distinct. But I will come to this issue later. This brings us to the question, why don't we see violations in the everyday life? Well, one possible answer is to refer to decoherence. And the other answer is exactly what I wanted to motivate now. It's because we are making coarse-grained measurements. Usually our measurements are not such that we project onto sharp quantum levels of the systems we look at. Usually our measurements are coarse-grained in a certain way. And the model system I will use in this talk to show you all the ideas we had is a large rotor. So consider you have a quantum system, a spin J. It has 2J plus 1 quantum levels. And you can think of J as large as you wish. Think of it 10 to the 10, 10 to the 20, 10 to the 30, whatever you like. It's really a large, macroscopically large quantum number J. Then the first tool we need is that we will use coherent states. So any state, any quantum state you wish, can be decomposed into this quasi-diagonal form. So any quantum state you like can be written in a quasi-diagonal representation of spin coherent states and some p function, which is similar to the Glauber function in quantum optics. So this is a real function, but to take into account coherences or possibly macroscopic superpositions, this can be negative at some places. And the spin coherent states are just the states that have maximum eigenvalue j if you apply the spin operator into the omega direction. So omega is just a mere notation for two angles in space, theta and phi. And now the important thing, assume that your measurement resolution is restricted. So you are just not capable of having perfect measurement devices, but they bunch together neighboring eigenvalues because of detector unsharpness or whatever you wish. And now it turns out that let us assume that we bunch together in such a way. So consider you have the spin J and you make a measurement of one component of the spin. Say you measure the set component. Then you can have possible outcomes from minus J to J. There are 2J plus 1 possible outcomes. And in sharp measurements, you could see all of them. And now consider you bunch them together such that you always coarse grain together delta M of them. And this would be one collective result called 1 here. And now if you bunch together all those, this would be result 2. So you see, there would be a smaller amount of possible outcomes because of your coarse-grained observable. And the coarse-graining condition which we will need is that this delta M, so the amount of coarse-graining or the uncertainty in the restriction in your measurement resolution, this should be much larger than square root of J, which is the intrinsic uncertainty of one spin coherent state.
And how can I justify the sharp edge between 1 and 2?
Very good question. I wanted for the persons who are experts in quantum measurement theory, I wanted to make this comment now. If you have this coarse-graining condition, and I think this is not only interesting but really an important feature here for coming to classicality, you can almost perfectly approximate your sharp border, so your coarse-grained von Neumann measurement, by a smooth overlap here with a PUVM element, where your PUVM elements are spin coherent states. So you assume that your coarse-grained measurement, where you project onto the set axis in a coarse-grained way, you can also see them as an integration over some area on the sphere, omega m bar, where all those spins lie that are consistent with this set component. And in this limit, they are practically the same. So you shouldn't worry about the question from Neumann or PUVM. It works both.
There will be a small amount of overlap.
Exactly.
Roughly how much?
Square root of J. But since you are much larger than square root of J, you won't see this overlap anymore. And there will always be a small disturbance and a small mismatch in the probabilities, but in the nice limit, which you maybe have time to explain later, this will go away. So for very large J, this error will be smaller and smaller, relatively. And this is, I think, the best you can do to achieve a transition from quantum mechanics to classicality. It cannot be a switch. It will be in such a way that the more cross-graining you give me, the better will my measurement outcomes be describable in a classical way. This is what comes next. So the better this is fulfilled, the better are all the other equations fulfilled I will be showing now. Now we are coming to macroscopic realism per se. So if you have such coarse-grained measurements, now where you bunch together neighboring eigenvalues, or you want to see this as PUVM in configuration space, You can use a classical distribution of spins. You can use an ensemble of spin for calculating your quantum probability outcomes of measurements. So there is this famous thing called the Q function. This is pretty well known. This is the definition. And it's practically just the expectation value of finding a spin along omega. This is a positive normalized distribution, and it can be interpreted as a probability distribution. And if your measurements are coarse-grained, you can use the Q distribution for calculating the probability of getting really the click at M bar. So you ask now yourself, what's the chance of really getting the outcome, one out of many outcomes M bar? And in quantum mechanics, you should use the P function and do the integration or summing over all the individual M's that are consistent with M bar. And under coarse-grained measurements, you can nicely calculate this by just integrating over this ensemble of spins associated to the quantum state. So this should be the picture here. If you have a magnifying glass and you're still able to resolve the individual quantum eigenvalues, then you would be able to even see the distribution of one spin coherent state over individual eigenvalues. So this is the spin, this is its component, and this is the distribution. But if you don't have this magnifying glass, you will only see these slots. And the probability of finding the system in one of these slots is just the integration of the ensemble over the sphere surface that is consistent with this set component. And this is exactly macroscopic realism per se. We have now something, if you want to see it, like a hidden variable description of the system. There exists this positive function, this Q distribution, which is enough for computing the probabilities. I can forget about quantum mechanics more or less now. The Q function will do the trick. I have a classical ensemble of spins, which allows me to calculate the probabilities. Maybe very briefly this. Let us assume now that you have this very large spin, and it's precessing in a magnetic field. So let us assume that the time evolution is a rotation of this spin. Now it goes one back step, and just remind you again. Consider you can make a sharp measurement. So this is the parity measurement. You project onto all the even ends and onto all the odd ends. This is not a coarse grained measurement. It's really a sharp measurement, bunching together sharply all the even and all the odds. And if you make such a measurement on the system, however large the quantum number will be, you will be able to evaluate the Leggett-Duck inequality. So the limit is 2. And I can always find some time distance of my possible measurements in the Leggett-Duck inequality, such that this inequality is violated for arbitrary value of j. On the other hand, if I'm restricted to fuzzy measurements, so I do not have this magnifying glass anymore, such that spin coherent states just would look like Kronecker deltas, then for practically arbitrary initial state, I can always describe the rotating quantum spin with this Schrödinger time evolution just as the classical ensemble rotating in space. So I then have the full description of the system with the Q function as a probability distribution of the spins, and the classical Hamilton function, which is a rotation, and the individual spins are just rotating by the Poisson bracket. So you see, it's really the contrast. Under sharp measurements, I would have violation of Leggett-Duck inequality for arbitrary large spins. Under coarse-grained measurements, not only I will fulfill the Leggett-Duck inequality, I will even have classical Newtonian evolution. And one comment, which is quite interesting. I told you here that we make parity measurement here. And in some sense, the parity measurement is extremely coarse-grained, because I take all the outcomes 1, 3, 5, 7, and so on, and call it slot 1. And I take all the outcomes 2, 4, 6, 8, and call it slot 2. So in some sense, this is an extremely coarse-grained measurement. Still, it led to violation of Leggett-Duck inequality. But this is not coarse-graining in our usual sense, because when we, from our classical notion, what we mean with coarse-graining is we want to bunch together those eigenvalues which are neighbored in real space. Yeah?
I was just wondering what happens if you fuzz a little bit in time with the parity measurement.
It depends, I think, on how much you fuzz it. But this would probably there's a trade-off between delta t and j. So the larger j gets, the more control you have to have on your delta t measurements. So this is a point, yeah. It's assumed that this is not the problem. You can choose your times as you wish.
So if you had a fixed fuzziness in time, If I for large fixed, J, you would wash out this effect. Okay?
Yeah, I think if you give me a fixed fuzziness in time, and I cannot be more accurate in time than that, then there will be some J for which I won't see anything anymore. I think, yeah. So whenever I say cross-graining in the future, I mean cross-graining where we bunch together quantum states which correspond to outcomes that are neighboring in real space. Yeah.
So I think this fuzzy measurement, right? Classical physics.
Yeah.
But the picture you put up there had on the next slide has these sort of, you do the neighboring coarse graining, but those are all, those also look sharp. There's no overlap between them. Whereas, as you said before, in the fuzzy one, there is a little bit of overlap.
Same comment as before. Think of, don't take it too literally. Here's this picture. Think of that here are 10 to the 20 individual quantum states, and that they bunch together to just some billion of slots. It won't matter anymore whether it's sharp von Neumann edges or slightly squared of J overlapping QPVMs. You will have a very small error in the probability calculations. And if you fix, so to say, all your outcomes on one screen and then make the system larger and larger, there will be more and more slots. And it will be classical in the limit. So you will need, relatively, you will make no mistake for large J.
So just to check, you can say that if I do a coarse graining like this that is sharp,
yeah,
not fuzzy, then I will not be able to violate a Leggett Gargett quality.
Right. Right. It, as long as the amount of bunching together is much larger than square root of J. Much larger than square root of J. Well, to put it really exactly, it might happen that in every, I don't know, 1 over J instances of measurement, there might be some small error. You might introduce an error because of these edges. But you're introducing an error anyhow. This is a bit technical and detailed. We can discuss it afterwards. That's a really interesting thing. But the amount of error you're introducing becomes smaller and smaller the larger J gets. So if you make J large, you will be able to compute quantum outcomes by just referring to the Q function. OK, and to remind you, the interesting thing is that in quantum mechanics itself, there is no difference between two neighboring states of the JZ component or two states which are separated by 10 to the 10 in number. They are orthogonal. Two neighboring states in are as orthogonal as two separated ones. It is our notion of labeling. We label them such that they appear in the right sequence after Stern-Gerlach method. But this is our notion of classical experiments and saying this is close on the screen to that, and this is far in the way on the screen to that. This goes into our labeling of the quantum states. In pure quantum mechanics, they are all orthogonal. So you see, there's something of classical physics we are putting in here into the cross-grained measurements.
Doesn't that have to do with the Hamiltonian? I mean, you can't just scramble up the numbers and do it however you want. I mean, there's some sort of, there is a physical mechanism by which you choose the binning to be of that sort and not of the first sort.
Well, it is probably very much related to the usual Hamiltonians we have in our measurement devices. Yes, sure. But, yeah. OK, how am I doing this time?
I think it's 15 minutes.
OK, I think I should hurry up. OK, to give you a bit an impression about this P function, which is the Glauer function, represents the quantum state, and the Q function, let me give you the following example. Consider, so unfortunately, this is really computable pretty hard. So this is only for spin J equals 10, but you get the picture even for much larger spins. So consider now we have a superposition of a spin pointing to the north and the spin pointing to the south. And consider we have a statistical mixture. So this is just a mixed quantum state where half of the spins are pointing to the north and half of the spins pointing to the south. And now if you think of J being very, very large, then this is something like a Schrödinger cat because it's a superposition of macroscopically distinct states. It's a superposition of very large spin pointing to the north and very large spin pointing to the south. And the P function is pretty ugly for the superposition. It's rapidly oscillating and negative, whereas the P function of the mixture is quite nice. But here comes the catch. Under coarse grained measurements, it's enough to take the Q function for your measurement outcomes, and they are practically identical. The Q function of those two states only differ in an amount that is exponentially small in J. And to give you the numbers again, we have the square of J condition. To see the quantumness of a size J Schrödinger cat, you need to resolve square root of J levels. If you're not able to resolve square root of J levels, there is no way to measure, now, pictorially speaking, in a basis such that this will show you different outcomes than that. And you see, if you measure only, if you only ask the spin, are you north or are you south, then this will give you 50-50 answers and this will give you 50-50 answers. But in principle, there exists a superposition basis where this guy will give you determinate outcome, always the same detector, and this will give you the 50-50. So, of course, in quantum mechanics, there are measurements allowing you to distinguish between this and that state. But coarse-grained measurements are not of that type. They do not allow you anymore to see that. Okay. If you want to remember anything of this talk, then it should be this. This is Albert Einstein, and he has this magnifying glass that makes sharp measurements of the person right next to him. This is a picture of Picasso, so it's very colorful, very strange. It's quantumly abstract. And under classical coarse-grained view, he sees the real person. Does anybody of you know the picture and knows which movie? Right, Charlie Chaplin. This is what Einstein sees if he doesn't have the magnifying glass of seeing quantum levels anymore. Okay, now I come to the second important point of the talk, which is non-invasive measurability. So though I should hurry up, this has to be explained, I think, in detail. Consider you have some quantum state rho, and now you make a coarse-grained measurement, and consider you really get one of many possible outcomes m bar. You get the coarse-grained outcome m bar. So the reduced quantum state after that measurement will be just the projection of this state and properly normalized. And of course, this quantum state, so the one which was consistent with the outcome of m bar, has a q function. So now there is a distribution of spins which are lying only between two circles of latitude on the spin. Only those survive because they are consistent with the outcome m bar. So first statement I want to make, fuzzy measurements only reduce previous ignorance about the spin mixture. What do I mean with that? If you have an initial Q distribution, then it can be seen as the weighted mixture of the Q distributions of the reduced states. This sounds more complicated than it really is. Consider I give you a classical mixture of spins, and then you make a measurement, and it tells you, well, they are all that around this set component. Then you know, out of this ensemble I gave you, you're now reduced to the sub-ensemble where the spins live on a ring. But you could have gotten another outcome where you would have had that ring. And if you mix them in the weighted way with the corresponding probabilities or with the integrations over the ring, then it should be the original distribution. So this is just a property of classical mixtures. But for non-invasiveness, we need more than that. And now comes the nice part. It's an argument in two steps. First step. Consider I give you an initial quantum state at time t0, and consider that without any measurement, the state evolves to time tj. So you have a quantum state, rho tj, and there is this positive probability distribution associated to the quantum state. Now, second step. Consider you made a measurement at time ti, and I hope this is still readable. Consider it had outcome m bar. So there exists now, instantaneously after this measurement, there exists a Q distribution at the time ti, where when you made the measurement at time ti, it had the outcome m bar. And now let evolve this reduced state until the time tj. What will be the Q distribution at this point? Well, it will be the state at ti, which had the outcome m bar, and then evolved from I to j. Well, and then you bracket and properly normalize, and then you have the Q distribution at the time tj, in the case that at time ti, you have made a measurement with outcome m bar. Okay, I hope the notation is clear. And non-invasive, this is the condition for non-invasive measurability. Non-invasive measurability now is the condition that this Q distribution, where you had evolution without measurement, left hand side, is equal to the weighted mixture, so with some probability, w m bar ti, you really had outcome m bar at time ti. And if you make the weighted mixture of all the possible outcomes here and letting them evolve, and if those two sides are the same, then you have non-invasive measurability. That means you make the measurement at time ti, it was reduced, But the reduced part of the Q distribution evolves in such a way that all the reduced parts build up that Q distribution, which would have evolved without any measurement. This is non-invasive measurability. And this can be rephrased into this condition here. So the sufficient condition for macroscopic realism is that the measurement and the time evolution should commute on the coarse grain level. It's not necessary that they have to commute on the sharp level. And now we are at the step where it becomes a bit more interesting, because now we see that there are two classes of Hamiltonians. There are those Hamiltonians for which this equation is fulfilled, or up to some small errors. And then there are Hamiltonians for which this equation is not fulfilled. And let me just name them. I call those classical for which this is fulfilled, and I call those non-classical for which this is not fulfilled. And I gave you already an example of a classical Hamiltonian. It's the rotation. For the rotation I already showed you, give me the rotation quantum Hamiltonian. Under coarse grain measurements, I will get classical physics. And now I will tell you about the second thing, which is pretty interesting. Now I'll tell you about this non-classical Hamiltonian, where you will see that we will not get macroscopic realism of classical physics, even if we have coarse grain. So this is the Hamiltonian, but it's enough if you believe me that it does the following. You start off with a quantum state pointing to the north, with a spin pointing to the north. So your initial state is plus J. And what this Hamiltonian does, he makes a time-dependent oscillating Schrödinger cat. He starts depopulating the north pole and building up superposition with the south pole until some time when it's 50-50. After some later time, it will be only south pole and so on. So it's oscillating. It's a pure state at all times, and it's oscillating between north, superpositions, only south, superpositions, and back again. Okay? And let me call it oscillating Schrödinger cat. And you see, when in the case where this is 50-50, I already have shown you the pictures, what it means to have a superposition or a mixture and that the Q functions are the same. And in the more general case, for every instance of time, not only in the 50-50 case, under fuzzy measurements, I cannot distinguish between this nice superposition state and the mixture. So at every instance of time, under this Hamiltonian evolution, under coarse grain measurements, I can describe the system by this statistical mixture, by this quantum mixed state, which is just with probability cosine square is north and with probability sine square is south. This description is sufficient to describe the quantum situation at every instance of time under coarse grain measurement. But now comes the catch. The time evolution of this mixture cannot be understood classically. So although at every instance of time, it's enough to have the Q distribution of these mixed states and do the calculations for probabilities, the Q function itself will evolve in a non-classical way. And how can this be seen? So consider you start off pointing to the north. After half the rotation, so to say, in Hilbert space, rotation in Hilbert space, it will be a superposition having this Q function, but you do not measure. So it will evolve to be fully populated along the south. And yet now you see, if you do not make a measurement at time t2, it will be to the south with 100%. However, second case, you let it evolve to the equal weight superposition, but then you make a measurement at time t1. With 50% probability, you will project it back to the north pole. With 50% probability, you will project it back to the south pole. And then there's only half the time left. So at time t2, it would be again in the 50-50, whatever way you wish, it would just have different sign. And now you see, this Q distribution is not the weighted mixture of those two possible cases. There was invasiveness. So the time evolution cannot be understood classically of this Q distribution. How much do we have left now?
5 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Are there any questions up to now?
Mm-hmm. I could still describe that with a non-contextual hidden variable model, right? You say classically. I mean, that's I can't understand it as just a plain classical system, but if I've got a hidden variable that's controlling its evolution, that would be fine, right?
Yeah, but a measurement has to project it back. You have to reset the time axis upon measurement. That's the trick. In classical physics, you would say if I measure the ensemble, it would just go on. And I didn't change my measurement. But here, if you have the 50-50 superposition and you make the measurement, then you project it back. So you somehow reboot the time axis to zero. This is where non-invasiveness comes in. So I wonder what this means in terms of, I think contextuality is probably not the right word here. It's just invasiveness or non-invasiveness.
Right. Later.
Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question?
Partially.
Okay. Okay, and in the final minutes, I just want to give you, this is really just the motivation. We're still working on that, but we think it is the following, that then, sorry, I should have asked now the following question. Now I showed you that that there exist mathematically non-classical Hamiltonians, which would allow to see violation of macro-realism even for large objects and coarse-grained measurements. So the question is, why don't we see it around us? And one question, of course, if you have an environment, would be decoherence. But without environment, still we wouldn't expect to see it. And maybe this is because these Hamiltonians are not realized. And one way that motivates that these Hamiltonians are unlikely, and this comes back to your question, there are some Hamiltonians realized, and these are the ones where the neighboring somehow works and point the basis in measurements and so on. And we believe that it can be phrased in terms of complexity. So let us now compare the two cases. We have this non-classical Hamiltonian, which made this oscillating Schrödinger cat, and we have this classical example of the Hamiltonian, which was a rotation in real space. And now let us decompose the spin J into a qubit chain. So you have your very large spin J, and now you just write it as a tensor product of lots of qubits, such that all the qubits together form the spin J. Then in this case, what we want to achieve, we want to let evolve all pointing to the north into a superposition. And in this case, we want to let evolve all pointing to the north in all pointing, well, a bit tilted with time. And we estimate the complexity of those evolutions by the number of operations we need to do them. So we'll do this only very briefly. And let us assume now, for the sake of simplicity, we want to do it only for a very small time step. So let us simulate only a small time interval delta t. We only want to go to cos omega delta t, sine omega delta t, and here the same. We only want to rotate by a very small angle omega times delta t. Then it turns out that what we would have to do to simulate this evolution on a circuit is you would really have to prepare lots of gates, because this is practically an oscillating or generalized GHZ state. So what you would have to do, for those who like quantum computation, you should rotate the first qubit and see not all the others. Then you have the right time, the right state of delta t. If you want to have the right state of two delta t, you should see not them back, rotate the first guy a bit more, and start see noting all the others again. So this is a pretty complicated stuff, because you need n computational steps per time interval. Whereas the rotation is really simple, because you have one global operation on all the qubits. So it's just a single step. This somehow, and I think this can be generally understood in that way, to see violation of macro-realism even under coarse-grained measurement. Therefore, it's necessary that your Hamiltonian can build up superpositions between macroscopically distinct states. And so you can see almost intuitively that this requires lots of internal flips and some very fancy program to achieve that. Whereas for the classical evolution, it's really trivial. It's just tensor product. Okay.
So if you don't mind, so it seems then that macroscopically distinct, even that concept, defines a sense of locality, which then tells you which Hamiltonians you're able to use,
yes,
which circuit elements you're able to use in this analysis. Is that correct?
Yes. What is plugged in here from the very beginning is the understanding of three-dimensional space and which points are neighboring in real space.
Yeah, but could you take it one step further and just, like, if you had some abstract notion of locality, then you would say, you know, everything that's localized in one region, but that's far away, so that's one macroscopic state, but then what's far away from it by whatever measure is another macroscopic state. If you were to back out from that picture, then you would have to say that circuit elements are preferentially, you know, local with respect to, you know, neighboring sites. Would that give you this?
We have thought about, yeah, it doesn't really matter whether you allow now the qubits to be neighboring or non-neighboring, or allow them to make multiple interactions.
No, but you define the qubits in a tensor product, and that requires a sense of separability. Maybe that's not the same as locality.
Yeah. Well, now I think that I didn't get it fully. What I just want to say is that you need the sense of locality in this way, that this spin and this spin are pretty close, and this spin and that are pretty far away.
Yeah, you need some sort of metric.
Yeah, that is what you need. I need to have the notion of real space distance or real space closeness to mimic it in my quantum notion. Yeah, okay. And now I'm starting to sum up. And I promised you to give you the answer to this question. What's now the key ingredient for the non-classical time evolution? Well, we see it like that. And if you have sharp measurements, then it's fine. You will have non-classical time evolution at all, practically all circumstances. Any non-trivial Hamiltonian will allow you to see violation of the Leggett-Clark inequality. Under coarse field measurements, it turns out that it depends on the Hamiltonian. The initial state is practically completely unimportant because your first measurement always acts as a preparation for the new state. And under classical Hamiltonians, you get not only fulfillment of Leggett-Clark, but even classical time evolution. And under non-classical Hamiltonians, you still have a violation of macroscopic realism. So the key ingredients for non-classical time evolution seem to be either sharp measurements or, under coarse field measurements, having non-classical Hamiltonians. And this should sum it up fully. So there's quantum physics. Under fuzzy measurements, and as I told you, you could consider the object always as very large, and classical Hamiltonians, you come to some kind of discrete classical physics. And in the limit of infinite dimensionality, where we had the discussion, so you should take the nice limit to make all the errors small, you end up in a classical physics that is really, again, continuous, point-wise, everything. But still, the points only look like points. The quantum fine structure is buried in them. And under non-classical Hamiltonians or sharp measurements, you end up in some kind of macroscopic superpositions, so quantum physics of large objects. And this is the scientific honesty. We put in here the notion of closeness. So we cross-train together those eigenvalues which were in real space neighboring, because as I said, in Hilbert space it would be totally abstract. All the different m values are orthogonal. We cross-train those for which we know what we want to have in the end. So that's why we have this arrow effect. Okay, that's basically, that just sums it up again. So I think I can skip this. So I thank you for your attention.
Before the big surprise. I think Raphael was.
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree with what you said, in large part, but I think it also can be seen as a kind of modern restatement of a very old idea. If you go back to sort of the very earliest discussions of, at least in the path integral language, which is Dirac's original, I think, suggestion of where classical limits come from, it comes from precisely washing out of very fine-grained interference patterns, where where paths that are near to the classical test differ constructively and so on. So if you were to measure positions absolutely precisely, then you wouldn't have this limiting process take place.
I think that, in the same spirit, I think people argued, why do we see trajectories in cloud chambers and such stuff?
That's similar, but right. So I think this is a sort of realization in the spin setting, almost a non-commutative geometry.
Yeah, with the additional input.
I
want to make one comment on that. With the additional input here, that we first demonstrate that you can make the quantum number itself infinitely large and still see quantumness. So not in the spirit of the Ehrenfest theorem. Making the quantum number large won't bring you classicality.
I think that's what I think. You just get finer and finer grained interference.
Yeah, but I just
want to see, as soon as you buzz out any amount of that.
Yeah. I just want to say it's hard to see that in phase space of a particle. There's nothing you can make more high dimensional.
Well, you can make the mass of the particle greater, and you make the action greater.
Sure, but if you make the mass larger, you don't increase the size of the Hilbert space. But with everything else, I fully agree.
Well, it's infinite. But the second related state observation is that you sort of contrasted this mechanism from decoherence against decoherence, right?
Yeah, I see complementary traits.
Yeah, I think it's right to contrast it with environmental decoherence. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you think in history's language, as, for example, as the word decoherence as in decoherent histories, I think you'll see that the two effects really are both different examples of this decoherence, this histories type decoherence.
Mm. Well, my comment here would be that I didn't mention it. It was written every now and then, but or maybe I should go back to some.
Coherence introduced by a certain kind of coarse grain.
Yeah.
But decoherent at the end of the history is lovely.
Was it written somewhere? Yeah, here it was written pre-measurement decoherence. I agree with you. One should distinguish between different types of decoherence, and there's this environmental decoherence where you really let the system interact with the environment and bring it into a statistical mixture. And this was not looked here yet. But if you go to this other type of decoherence, which is called pre-measurement decoherence, so you have the system, you couple the apparatus, and then the environment only attacks the apparatus, then this is equivalent to the to starting with coarse graining in the beginning of measurements. So in this sense, I see equivalence between, and probably full mathematical equivalence, between coarse-grained measurements and pre-measurement decoherence, between this type of decoherence, which is not full-fledged environmental decoherence. But I want to make one statement that if you have non-classical Hamiltonians, there will, under no circumstances, any decoherence you wish be a classical description of the system. Because there's a quantum Hamiltonian.
The history framework doesn't just allow it. Well, let's leave it.
Sure.
Why don't we take one last question, because we're running out of time. Daniel's next.
So you said that the initial state didn't matter much for this question. So what about if you have a non-classical ancilla state that is interacting with the system but is not itself of interest to you?
The initial state is important if you have the sharp measurement, and I think you should take some initial state which is not trivially just gets a phase due to the Hamiltonian. You should not take an energy eigenstate.
So for the coarse grain.
Okay, under the coarse grain measurement, the initial state is absolutely unimportant. If you give me coarse grain measurement and a classical Hamiltonian evolution of the system, then you can start off with the widest Schrödinger cat, with the widest interference of the spin system. Just compute the Q function, all your measurement outcomes will have a classical description, even under the wildest initial quantum state.
Sorry, but this is if you're measuring it initially, you said.
No, you take this wildest initial state you wish, take one Hamiltonian out of this classical class, and then measure at instances of time, coarse grain measurements, you will not violate Levitt-Clark inequality. There will be a classical motion according to the classical counterpart of your classical Hamiltonian.
So this is including if you have like two systems, this one you're measuring at intervals of time, and it occasionally interacts with this other system which you're not measuring.
Okay. This is more tricky. I would still say so. If you have two systems under coarse grain measurements, it would still make it impossible to see quantum phenomena. Let me give you maybe have 12 more seconds to answer this. There's the calculation by Paris. He takes as initial state the generalized singlet state. So he takes a spin J, but maximally entangled spin J state, two observers, Ellis and Bob, and if they make sharp parity measurement on this spin J state, they will violate some type of CGSH inequality, but on the coarse grain measurement of Ellis and Bob, there's a classical description, even with this fully entangled state. You just wash it out on the coarse grain measurements. So my answer would be still, there would be a classical description of this situation as long as you have coarse grain measurements.
Okay, I think we should thank the speaker again.